Okay, so we're going to do a little bit of this, and so we'll start with a little...
What are you guys talking about?
All right, everybody, welcome back to, I don't want to say a rushed episode, but a late night episode of What Are You Guys Talking About?
What are you guys talking about after dark?
Pretty much, yeah, because we had to push this one a bit later. Ed had Spain v. Italy yesterday, which sadly Spain did not go through, but it's okay, buddy. It's okay. And I was watching the England game tonight. Wow, what a game. Like, so proud of England.
Good game, right?
So awesome. It's just a great team to watch. You know, as I said, I have no stake in this other than I live here. But you know what I mean? Like, I honestly can say it looks like a great team. Like, it's really good to watch them play. It was a really great match. Denmark also played really well tonight. So,
yeah, man,
you know, it was a nice little sports date with the wife tonight. We were on the edge of our seats. So, but
was
anyways.
She happy?
Yeah, of course. England wins.
Nice.
Very happy with that, right? So, but moving on to what we're doing here, I just want to start out with, in case you're joining us maybe for the first time or you haven't listened to us very often, you know, what are you guys talking about? Well, this is a show where we talk about indie filmmaking kind of via the things that we watch. And so you're very much getting an inside view of Love Victoria Productions Studio, which we are an independent film studio that makes things, lots of different things, including this. So we just try to give you our view on how we would look at something, how we would tackle something, maybe our views on whether it was done properly or not. And we don't really limit ourselves personally to just independent films. We look at everything. So, but it's always with the view, kind of an indie filmmaker view, because we don't work for Warner Brothers or for Universal or any of those other big companies. Not saying we wouldn't want to, but just saying we're indie as much as it comes. So with me, as always, is Edward Burgos, my favorite buddy slash business partner slash everything, really, aside from my wife. I have my wife who, you know, she's kind of like the other part of the trilogy, but you know what I mean? So if I were Fellowship, Ed would be like Two Towers, and then, you know, Becky, it's always Return of the Queen. So you
Return
know what I mean?
King. That's right. That's Return of the Queen.
That's how it would be. You know what I mean? So yeah. But we hope you enjoy. Today we're going to be talking about Indie Game the Movie, which had a massive impact on me when I saw it. Still continues to have an impact and really does explain, at least for me, kind of some of the reasons I do what I do in indie filmmaking. And hopefully Ed can talk a little bit about that. So one last thing before we get started. We are, of course, on a big subscription share everything push. So please, best place to catch us is on SoundCloud. That's where the podcast is made and where it's distributed. You can check us out on any other podcast platform, though. I know Podbean is our most popular, but we're also on Apple Podcasts. You can get us on Spotify, things like that. If there is, you know, something that you want us to be put on that we're not on, which I don't think that would happen, but if it did, then please just drop me an email and say, hey, Mouth, can you go ahead and get us on that? So otherwise, check us out on our website, www.lovevictoriaproductions.com. That's LAVICTORIA productions.com. Social media pages, both for the company and for us. We have Instagram accounts, Jazzy J. Chiro and Anano LVP. We've got a TikTok account with LVP Film Life, which has a lot of trailers
right.
and teasers and fun stuff on that. LinkedIn account for the company. Not incredibly active, to be honest with you guys, but if there's something business related that you want to talk about with us, or you just are on LinkedIn and want to check out the posts that we do, then please, please do. And finally, we're on Twitter. You know, we are active, at least somewhat active on Twitter. You can find me at Mouth Love Victoria, or you can find Ed at Ananoski Prod, and that's ENANOSKIPOPROD. Sorry.
You spelled the hard one really well, and then the easy one.
Well, these things happen, right? I'm a filmmaker, not a teacher.
Damn it, Jim.
Damn it, Bone. Oh, damn it, Jim. Yeah, Bone's over here. All right, so we're going to be talking about Indie Game, but I think the best way to kind of get into this is to give it over to someone who hasn't watched this film 6,000 times. So, Ed, first impressions. And again, we do first impressions to do it without spoilers. So Ed's going to give you a couple minutes now of what he thought of the film without spoiling it for you to see whether you would be interested in watching this. Take it away, Ed.
Okay, so you've mentioned this film to me several times in the past, and I had no real expectations coming in, other than that it would probably be an interesting insight into the business of gaming and independent game and stuff like that. But honestly, this was incredible. Just as a film, I'm not talking about like, oh yeah, you know, it's interesting to find out how they do this and how they do that. But the drama, man, like, is intense. And I, you know, whenever we do these films for What Are You Guys Talking About, I often, like, write notes just because, like, I want to write down my thoughts and stuff like that. But with this one, I couldn't. Like, I was absolutely riveted by the story. And I always do this. I don't watch documentaries for a while, like, you know, high quality kind of cinema documentaries.
Mm.
And then I do, and I fall back in love with them because, like, they're amazing. And this is such a great example of an incredible documentary where they have mined the 300 plus hours of footage that they had, and they put together this amazing story that I think anyone who's creative whatsoever in their life should absolutely 100% watch this.
Very good. So, yeah, I think, you know, you can boil it down to the three crowds that we would suggest for this one. First crowd is our regular listeners. You know, when we go in depth on this one, Ed, you know, we'll kind of pass over to me to talk about, because this film had a really big impact on my life as a creative. A kind of a failed attempt at something.
I could totally see it as well. Like, I could see you reflected in this movie so much.
Yeah, yeah. So, and we'll talk about that, because it still has a big impact for me. It's one of those films that's like, you know, when I want to get back to exercise, I watch all the Rocky films, because it always makes me want to go out nice. And work harder. You know what I mean?
This is
a film that, like, I need right now, because I'm working on a feature script. I'm under a lot of pressure. And this is a kind of film for me that says it's going to be okay. Like, you just got to barrel down, forget that, you know, don't have any doubts, you got to do that. So that's the first crowd this is for. Second crowd, this is a good documentary. This was well made, really well made. And it was marketed just as well, and we'll talk about that more when we go into the longer view of things. But if you like documentary films, like you're into your Netflix where you check out blah, 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 you just love watching them, this is one that you may have missed because... I
mean, yeah, completely. This should have won some awards, man.
I think it did. You know, I think it did. I haven't had a ton of time. It's the funny thing, when I'm so passionate about this film, like, you'd think I'd research the hell out of it. I didn't. I'm like, I just want to tell you about how I felt about this film. So apologies to you on the other side that, like... You can still go to IndieGameTheMovie.com or IndieGame.com, and you can buy this film plus the special features, which will tell you everything you really need to know about it. But that's the second crowd. And then I would say third crowd is, like Ed said, if you are one of those people who, like, looks at video games, because I get this a lot because I'm a video gamer. If you're not and you look at people and say, like, I don't even understand what this is all about, it really does explain to you, at least from an independent studio perspective, you know, exactly what it is.
The art of it, right?
The, like, art the of
passion,
it, right?
The art, the
because
yeah.
You know, just a small disclaimer. Well, it'd have to be a larger disclaimer because now we're starting to go into description, but it won't give spoilers away. Like, listen, 2010, when all this takes place, was a renaissance in video games, a huge, huge, amazing renaissance. Because what happened is technology got to the point where programmers and creatives could work closely together to make simpler games, and that's what started happening. So, you know, I'll tell you more spoilers when we move on from first impressions, but if you ever wanted to know a little bit more about the video game industry, but were afraid to ask, this is what to watch. You know what I mean? Like, this will totally explain to you the pressures they are under for releases and things like that. So that would be my first impressions, three people. So if you're our loyal fans like Eric, go watch this. You'll love this.
Oh, Eric will love this.
Exactly.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? You know, you'll love this, you know. Second kind of people, you know what I mean? If you like good documentaries.
You like documentaries, yeah.
Then this is a really well shot. As I said, it looks good too. So that always matters to me in documentaries. Yeah. I don't know why. It's probably because I'm becoming more of a director type person now. But, you know, the quality of your documentary can affect the way I think about it.
It just adds so much to it, man, when you've got like some beautiful shots in there. And we'll talk about it, but go on.
That's right. And then, of course, the third one is people that want to look into the video game industry. So that's our first impressions. I think, is that all we need to say about that, Ed? I think it is.
I think so. I mean, like, you know, we're obviously both absolutely in love with this film. So, you know, strap in.
That's right. Strap in and get ready for the ride, guys. So where should we start, Ed? I'll leave that up to you. This is the part where we get more loosey-goosey. And we get to do what we want to do. But, Ed, where do you want me to start talking about this film? And then I can pass it back over to you.
Okay. Well, I mean, just talk a little bit about, like, you know, when you first watched this and the impact that it had on you. And, you know, just what how it inspired you, I guess.
Right. So, I mean, I've always been a bit of a computer nerd, you know, someone who was into programming, into things like that. I chose not to make a career out of it, but probably around 2010, 2011, I had started thinking, you know, I'd just become a lawyer. It's one of those things, I just qualified as a lawyer. and I was really reconsidering it because it was hard. And it wasn't, just wasn't, you know, again, it's whether you do things for passion or whether you do things for money. And I would say a lot of my early legal career I did for money, not because I was really passionate about it. I'd say I've been in the business now 10 years. So, you know, I'm a little
I've grown into the role.
But back then, it just was hard. And I was like, maybe I should be doing what I want to be doing. You know what I mean? So I watched this film and I was like, yeah, I know how these guys feel. Because the most interesting thing about this film, you know, and again, this is just because I am analytic and narcissistic. You know what I mean? I'm a person that looks at myself through everything else. You know, each of these characters that you meet have an element of me in them that I can see myself in. So when you meet Phil for the first time, I'm like, yeah, I get him. When you meet, especially when you met Eduardo, you know what I mean? Like, aspects
of
Edmund, right? Sorry, Edmund. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of you, Eduardo. So no, when you meet Edmund, like, God, like, certain aspects of his introvertness are like closely held secrets by me. And Ed would know this. Like, Ed on the phone would know this.
Yeah, I was thinking about you when he was talking about, like, the drawings as a kid and how he kind of implemented, like, his fears and his and you know, things that he experienced as a kid into his art, and it made me think of you and your process.
Yeah, I mean, I assume there's a lot of us that play video games and like that kind of stuff, but he was a kid kind of like me that just felt a bit misplaced, you know what I mean? That, like, he wasn't quite where he was supposed to be, and I always felt that way as a child. Like, not because my parents were mean to me or not because of anything, but, I mean, it just was tough. I just wasn't like other kids, and so you just get picked on because of that, and I could see that in him, and I could see that, like, he was uber enthusiastic to try to figure out what he was going to do with his life because of that, and, like, those are all my friends. Those are all the people I hung out with. That's all we wanted, was to have fun with our lives later on. You know what I mean? Because we couldn't understand why we were the way we were. So I see that, you know, even Tommy, like, Tommy I love because, like, wow.
I identified hard with Tommy, I'll be honest with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I totally saw that, Ed, because it was just, to me, it was like, you know, some of the sacrifices that you have made because you wanted to be an artist. And you know, that's why when you look at Tommy, I love the way they presented it, because they don't make any bones about it, you know? And it's like, you know, I have to sit here and defend Ed sometimes. Ed has to defend himself, but people will shit on you for that kind of situation. They do. Ed, you know, Ed could tell you better than I could, but I've seen people shit on Ed about it. And it's like, listen, mate, like, what are you going to do? Like, we have to create content.
We all make choices.
Exactly. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this is a sacrifice he makes, you know, so that he can get to where we need to be.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. There was one particular moment where I was thinking to myself, oh, yeah, I totally understand that. But then at the same time, and I thought this about him, I thought, there's no, and I think he might have said it, actually, there's no way I could turn around and not do this again, like, and not, like, put his, all of this
in. Actually, you know, I guess there is the strongest connection between the characters that I, you know, would be actually you and Tommy, because of the things that are important to him. First of all, he's like, I make games for me, not for you. You know what I mean? And, like, that is Ed's philosophy all the way. Why? Because you cannot create the content we need. Even if we're going to make the best feature in the world, you know what I mean? We still have to love it. Like, we have to love it like it's our child, because, man, like, it's the hardest thing that I found about this is you'll write a screenplay or a part of a screenplay, but then you've got to come back to it 100 times. You may not get it all done in one time. So it's all great to have all these ideas, but if you can't love them and you can't live in them, then you're done. Like, you're just not going to create something that's quality, because you're not going to like it. You know what I mean? And that's, we see this with some of our friends that were crew on the bigger features. And they're all like, well, I just would like to create something that I like, you know, something that's mine. And I get that. Like, it must suck to have to, like, carry around everybody else's stuff. You know what I mean? Because if you're in filmmaking, you want to be making your stuff. So that was one of Tommy's big things. The sacrifice aspect as well. You know, that time where he's sitting in the diner at 4:12 in the morning, like, it made me think of you, Ed. Because you're like, I can – because Ed will always say, like, I can pay for me. Like, he makes enough – you know, Ed makes enough money, he can take care of himself. That's not what the issue is here. But, you know, he lives a very frugal life because, You know, that's what we need him to do right now, unfortunately. Like, we got to make the content. So he needs a day to create Dirty 20. He needs time to create Carnivale Lore. And you can't be at a 9-to-5 every day for that. So, you know what I mean? It's tough. It's tough.
It was such a, like, inspiring moment. Seriously, like, I'm getting the feels again. Like, you know, at the end where, like, because it opens up with, like, a fair amount of negativity for Tommy, like, right from the beginning, right? It sets it up beautifully, like, narratively. I think the way they built the story is fantastic, but it starts off looking like it might not work out at the beginning, and then there's this very small moment of joy that Tommy's getting from watching people play the game,
but
you know.
But even that reminded the phone conversation part. So if you want to know
exactly,
if you guys want to know exactly what it's like between Jason and Ed on the phone when we talk, like, so when Tommy's sitting there saying like, but I don't care, like, I don't want the reviews, like, Ed gets really anxious, okay, and I hope I'm not telling too much.
No, but
this is the podcast where we're supposed to be like, it's like the psychologist chair.
That's right.
You know what I mean? But like, he gets really anxious. I don't. I get crazy happy. Like, crazy happy when these things happen. We got greenlit for something like 2 weeks ago, and like, fuck, like, I was all over the place. But at the same time, like, we got off the phone with the guy who greenlit us, and Ed was like sweating, and he's like, and I'm like, are you all right? And he's like, I should feel happier about this. I'm like, no, it's okay, you can feel however you want to feel, but what's going on? And you're like, I just don't know. Like, oh my God, like, it's all happening now, isn't it? And I was like, yes, it is. And it was amazing to me because it was like, first of all, I love when I get to see someone else that close. Like, it's just a joy for me to be partnered up with anybody that lets me in that much and says, I'm telling you the truth. Like, I'm scared. You know what I mean? Like, that's cool to me. I'm scared too. I just make a lot of noise to cover up that fact. You know what I mean? but it just, that's why when Tommy was doing it, it really, that is what happens, guys. Like, not everybody who makes this stuff is the crazy, wants to go out there. You know what I mean? Like, knows what they're doing every time. That's more the major studios. We're talking independent studios here. And so we are people on our own. Like, we are literally told how poor we're going to be because our films are never going to make money, or your video games are never going to make money. Yeah. The thing that'll get you with video games is the dev cycle. I mean, did you hear what Edmund said? 6 years. I made more today than I've made in 6 years.
I mean, like,
so, you know what I mean? I just
the whole and perhaps we should explain. We're just throwing these names out. So Edmund and Tom, or Tommy, they work together on this this game, Super Meat Boy, I think.
Super Meat Boy, one of the greatest games ever made. If you haven't played it, awesome. By the way,
I really wanted to play all the games, but Edmund is kind of the creative director. And Tommy is like the programmer, you know. And again, it's funny because it does kind of reflect a little bit our kind of dynamic and stuff.
And that's fine. And I think you're right to talk a little bit more about the research. But let's step back then just for a second to tell you about the scene. Like, let's set the scene for you. So 2010 is when all this is happening. And now that is the era of the Xbox 360. So believe it or not, like, I can't believe this now because we're 10 years down the line. But this is when Microsoft was king, okay?
That's crazy.
And Microsoft, everybody had an Xbox 360. I had one. Yeah. You know, anybody who was playing that as opposed to the PlayStation 3, I think, which was out at the time. And part of the reason it was so successful is Microsoft got really smart, and they did what no one else at the time had really been doing except for Steam. And with Steam, that's a whole different conversation. But they found out that independent video game studios could create with small teams and make a really decent profit off of this thing. So they talk about it extensively in the film itself, but think of it this way. Most of these big budget games that they are still being made today, so the tentpole games are still the bastion
of Mass Effect, stuff like that.
Modern Warfare, you know, this was Call of Duty. Like, all of these things are mega produced. And at that time was just around the time that Activision had merged with Blizzard, so you were getting some mega big games coming out at that time. Bethesda Software doing all their stuff. So, whole point being, there still was this tentpole society going on, and that is very much still how video games are run today. However, Xbox saw this niche community, and they realized that people were creating games now using Unity, which is a really easy programming software that uses Python and C++ and JavaScript to do quite a few different things. But of many of the games that you saw, Ed, on the screen, because they have three games that are, is it three or four games that you watch in the documentary? But I encourage you to watch the credits.
So it's like, yes, the credits was awesome.
Because the credits has... No, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say that the three games were Braid, Super Meat Boy, and Fez.
Right. So the first one that comes out with that is Braid. And Braid came out in like 2008, 2009, and it was mind-blowing. Because it was simple. Mm. The reason it was mind-blowing is because instead of having these uber games, right? Like Mass Effect is the one used in there to kind of explain that the things had become really big budget. It was a platformer. It was a simple platformer. The only thing that was really unique about it was this time mechanic he put into the puzzles that he put into platformer. And I mean, it would blow you away. And the story, I mean, this is that particular guy, because he went on to do
Jonathan Blow.
Jonathan Blow goes on to do The Witness, which is one of the greatest puzzle games ever made. Just an amazing puzzle game. And so
I was super intrigued by Braid.
So that's what I mean. Braid has this like romance story built into it, but it's told almost as a dream. Like it was the first time, and he's really good about explaining this much better than I, about how expressive it was about what he was doing. Yeah. So one of my things with video games always was I didn't feel they were expressive enough. You know, Super Mario is not expressive. You know what I mean? It's fun and it's jolly, but it doesn't do anything. The closest thing that I've ever gotten was probably some of the Final Fantasies because they're very operatic, and maybe like Legend of Zelda because I always want to be the hero saving the princess. But generally you had this distance between video games and the reality of what people felt. Much different from films, which thrive on that, which thrive on those personal connections that make you love the film, right? Where they figured out, and this was around 2008 to 2005, let's say, to 2010, that this could be put into a video game. And so you saw the numbers. You had Castle Crashers, you had Braid, you had all these games that all of a sudden make millions, and they're made by teams of like five. So where before you were making, you know, possibly billions, but you're dividing it up to a team of like 2,000, here, you know, you saw it. This is, you know, Phil Jupiter's argument. He's like, it's me and that French guy or French Canadian guy over there. That's it. There's nobody else. And it drove, you know, that drives him nuts. And we'll talk all about Phil in a minute here. But that's to set the scene for you. This was a huge renaissance. And it has died down since then. I would say the independent video game scene is now flooded. Like, absolutely flooded. So you've got 6 billion games everywhere. They're all relatively cheap. But only the best now really rise to the top. Where back then, it didn't really matter if it was the best. If it was original or different, you really wanted to try it. So if you are still interested, go on Steam. Steam still carries a ton of indie games that you may never have heard of, and you can pick them up there and play them. And I'm telling you, you're missing out if you don't try at least some of them. You know, these are the things that came out afterwards, were things like Hatafel Boyfriend. Who had ever made a dating sim about pigeons? Why? Because back in the day, like, you couldn't get money for that. But now it was like, well, if it's a weird enough concept, we'll give it a try. You know, the follow-up to Super Meat Boy, which became, like, again, it's a platformer on par with Mario, guys. They're not lying. It's that good. I beat it, you know, 5 years ago and was blown away. Because I don't often beat games. I'm not very interested enough to. And this one was just that good. His follow-up, The Binding of Isaac, was even weirder, but a lot of fun as well. It's more of a dungeon crawler like Legend of Zelda. So that's the scene, and that's how all of this is going on. And I think the best way to zero in on one particular case with this is, what did you think, Ed, of Phil Jupitus? Not Phil Jupitus, sorry, Phil Fish. Phil Jupitus is that guy from English
Never
TV.
Never mind the bus coach.
Yeah, there we go, there we go. So, Phil Fish, what did you think of Phil Fish?
Again, man, the drama in this film is so compelling. So Phil is he's a hard guy to love, I think. Just because I don't know if maybe he has a little bit too much gumption or he has a lot of like confidence, right? But he's very much a perfectionist, and it seems to be kind of playing against him throughout, and he has this very difficult situation, which made me feel super uncomfortable while I was watching it. But he has the situation with his early business partner,
right?
And I was like, oh God, that's a situation that no one would ever want to be in, right? And it made me think, oh God, like, if anything like that ever happened between me and Jason, that would fucking kill me. Because he, you know, he wants to murder this guy who won't sign this paper so that he can get on and do this thing. And again, the way it's edited together, it just really ramps up. But I mean, by the end of it, I had kind of fallen in love with Phil. Like, I wanted him to succeed. And I was fascinated by the game itself, by Fez.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing about Phil, because I've been on both sides of the spectrum with him. Because, Phil, like, please listen to this someday, because I do think you and I probably share an awful lot in common. Because when I see you, you just have that kind of confidence that people get pissed about with me, but it's like, it's how I know how to drive something forward. And it's clear you use it to drive yourself forward. So I'm with you. Like, I'm with you on that. Now,
yeah, you can't hate him for it, right?
No, like, I mean, I get pissed. My sister, 2 days ago, I was talking about, you know, the thing we've been greenlit for. And I was talking with her and I'm like, and the writing will be great because, you know, I'm going to knock this one out of the park. And she's like, you are so overconfident with your writing. I'm like, I have to be. Like, do you want me to say, oh, it's going to all be...
If I'm not, who will be?
Exactly. Like, if I don't believe in what I'm writing as being good, like, then who else is? Like, Jesus. Yeah. So that's not me trying to say I'm better than other people. That's just me saying my stories are interesting, at least
it's
to me.
It's how you G yourself up.
However,
this whole, like, you know, and I suffer from this as well, this false humility, right? Like, this, like, oh, I have to be humble because people will like me more if I do that. You know, that's not good either, right? Like, it's about why you do.
No, things, right? I mean, it's why we talked about it all the last podcast. So if you listen to that, you heard about Mythic Quest, you know, like a million times. Oh, and Ed, you have to watch that episode. So to spoil it for you, in that particular episode, there is a girl who used to be a tester. So a video game tester, that is a person, just so you know, with no experience whatsoever. You don't need a degree or anything. You just go in
they
and
just
you,
play video games.
It's sometimes what you do if you don't want to go to college yet. You know what I mean? I think I should have done a couple years of that because it looked pretty dope, but it doesn't pay very much, but it's enough to get your bills.
I think I had a buddy who went to like Australia and like lived off of doing that.
Yeah, you
like,
can. No, you totally can. Grandma's Boy is all about the people who do that. You know what I mean? So, but she decides she wants to be a programmer. And so you have the two lead characters, Poppy and Ian, are in this room together. They're like, first she's in there and they're with her and they're like, they're screaming at her and they're like, you're an idiot, don't talk to us. And she goes to say something and they're like, they block her and they talk to each other and like, can you believe what she's done?
They're really kind of mean.
Because, they're really mean because she's trying to pitch this, like, this thing she's been working on, this programming code. It's pretty shit. It's a goat that eats a can. But she is like, it's going to be dope. I'm telling you, you don't understand. And so she keeps trying to do this, and then she was trying to enroll into UC Berkeley's programming, and she doesn't get into it. And so she goes to them to be like, you know, what's up?
I need my
testing job back because I was going to be a programmer. And then she shows them that, and they're like, have you been working on this the whole time? And they're like, yeah. And they're like, it's really shit. And she's like, I know, but it's going to be good. And then there's this speech, and this is the part, to the point. This was the part I had to have Ed watch because it's so true. He says, do you see that floor out there? And at the, you know, in the, even in the show, they've got like 30 programmers out on the floor. Do you want to know why none of those people are the creative director or why none of those people have their game made? Because they don't believe in their stuff. And I just wanted Ed to see that because that's everything to me. Like, if we believe in it, other people will. And that's what carries the train. And that's why I think Indie Game is another great example of that. These people go through absolute hell to get their games out, but they believe in it. You know what I mean? Yeah. And they make sure that the people around them believe in it as well. So that's, I think, one of the most important messages you can take from this. And that's kind of where Phil is in the good side. Now,
I loved the line that, is it Jonathan Blow, which they play twice because that's how powerful it was. But he's talking about the difference between like the big games that are polished to death,
the rough, the smoothing out the rough edges. Yes. And that's the part that I thought would speak to you about indie film, because that is very much how I see indie film. You know, it's funny. I was just watching Luca today, which is an amazing Pixar film if you haven't watched it yet.
Oh, okay. Yeah, people have been asking about
very
that
good cinema. Film, but it takes place in the Italian Riviera, which I was laughing with my wife because I was like, one of my all-time favorite horror movies, which is Spring, you crazy Benson and Moorhead guys. I love you guys.
Yes.
Can't believe you mortgaged a house for that film, but Jesus, I love love that film. And that takes place in the Riviera too. And I was just noticing like the differences in how you present it versus Spring. I'll probably watch Spring tonight just to be like, yeah, that is presented differently. But it's just indie allows you to get into the cracks of things and talk about things that you're not going to have permission to talk about on a big budget film. So
exactly.
And it's why it's, you know, it's why we feel so passionate about Lee and other people that, you know, that we have in our circle, like Hex Media and things like that. Like, this is a voice that needs to be heard. And so the other reason I love indie game is because it gives you a model for how that could work. You know what I mean? So Xbox was the first to kind of discover that. Now Steam has done that. Actually, believe it or not, Nintendo on the Nintendo Switch are now one of the best indie developers. So that's another place you can go. But they give a really good platform for independent, you know, video game studios to try to get on. So Hades, you know, was really well promoted by them, kind of rose to prominence on the Switch. Now it's available on a lot of platforms, but, you know, these are the things that happen. So I'm just putting it out there, guys. It's like everyone always tells me indie film's dead and that it won't work. Have a look at this film and tell me that we couldn't try to replicate something like this within our own film community. And God knows I'll be working on that. But back to Phil Fish. So
yes.
I realize that you couldn't see all of Phil Fish. And you haven't, I don't know if you researched him. I told you to, but like, I don't think we've had time to. So the thing you missed that I was telling you about before, in the behind the scenes, which if you want, you have to buy like Indie Game, the movie special edition. You get like 100 behind the scenes features, which were awesome, and kind of an expanded story on everything. But when it came to Phil Fish, the one you remember the most is when he goes to Comic-Con with all the other Indie Game, the movie people.
To PAX, yeah.
No, because you didn't see this.
This is a different one. Okay, gotcha.
You didn't see this. So he goes to like Comic-Con, and he's on a panel talking about Indie Game, the movie, and they ask about different video games. And a Japanese, you know, not presenter, someone who's there, a Japanese person, asks him a question about what he thinks about Japanese games. And his response is, I think they suck. Right to the person's face. And it's like, everyone else in the room realizes. Everyone else in the room realizes it was the worst thing to say. And he has a reason for it. And he says, listen, the reason I think that is you spend 6 hours in a Japanese game on a tutorial trying to learn things, where American games are now getting you out and running. I mean, that was the whole point of Super Meat Boy, is that you learn the game as you go along.
As you go,
So, and I will agree, if you had played PlayStation 2 games, like, Jesus, like, the tutorials were getting so tedious, so long, like, holding your hand all the way through. It's, again, smoothing the rough edges. And so that's the point he makes. However, and this is where I did feel I was pissed at him, but I also felt a kinship because I've been known to say stuff in the wrong place at the wrong time. Like, he just didn't get it. He didn't understand that, like, you do not say that at Comic-Con when a Japanese person asks you about games from their country. Like, it's just disrespectful. You know what I mean? That's why I actually like your comment, Ed. And not actually. I mean, I do like your comment, like, hard to love. Like, it's like, you want to give them the benefit of the doubt. And then you get into things like, I mean, have you played Fez at all, Ed? Have you seen it?
No. I mean, I obviously in the film and stuff, and it looks like just the artwork and the vibe.
Right. So this is what I mean. He is an artist. You have to play this game. Yeah. If it only costs like $5. Like, it's not an expensive game because it's indie. In early indie games, at least nowadays, they're more expensive, like 20 to 30. But back in the day, these games were like $5. So you could get them on Humble Bundle. That was the original way to get like tons of good indie games.
Humble Bundle
used to package them for different things. And so, you know, Fez is amazing. It doesn't get released in the film. You have to buy the special features if you want to see the longer story about the release of Fez. But it gets released to huge fanfare. I mean, it wins all sorts of awards. It was amazing. You know, it did everything it said. When the guy at PAX, you know, when Tycho is there telling you, you have a great
Jerry
thing.
Holcomb. That was so cool.
It's Tycho, right?
You know what I mean? He's, well, for me, he's Omen Drawn from Acquisitions Incorporated.
Oh, like, sure.
I don't know him as a comic book artist or a video game
comic book
guy.
Artist, just person extraordinaire. Watch his, and I encourage you, watch Penny Arcade's Behind the Scene. They have a full free documentary you can watch on their website that will tell you about what it's like behind the studios there. They are the coolest indie people in the world. Like, just the coolest. Someday we'll be taking our films and then saying, figure out how you can do this with your video games, man, because we're going to have a good time. We're going to have a good time together. Again, for me, this was all a genesis. So because we're going to run out of time to talk about it too much, I literally formed a video game company on the back of watching this film. And I had created all sorts of dev. The problem I had is back then, I had no idea how to project manage because I was just a lawyer. Now I'm a project manager, and I'm much better at assembling a team. But back then, I was trying to teach myself how to program, you know, quick enough to get this done. And I'm a pretty fast learner, but you're not going to make those kind of, I mean, again, listen to what they said, 6 years. Six years of programming and checking and making sure it's right before it came out. I mean, Phil took, God, it was originally supposed to come out in like 2006, and it comes out in 2012. So, yeah, it was, I guess, 6 years again. And he makes a good point. I do, that's what I mean. He always has rationale to what he says, and that's what I love about it. It's always like, listen, like Red Dead Redemption,
he's seven years in development.
Like, he's not wrong, guys. Like, these had huge teams. He just, I think sometimes he takes it all too personally, which leads me on to like final thoughts for Phil Fish, because what if you did the research, you realize there was a Fez 2, or at least there was supposed to be. I don't know if it ever got released, but that was kind of the beginning, at least last time I checked, and I haven't Googled the guy lately, but this was a couple years ago. You know, Fez 2 became just like Fez 1. And the problem is he couldn't get it released. He couldn't get it out. And he just yelled and yelled and yelled at his fans about, like, stop pestering me about it. Now, the problem you have is, like, that's when my producer hat comes on and says, well, now you're established. You have to give the people what they want, because your success rides on them buying your stuff. You know, like, that's when you're looking at it more like a business. The first one, fine. If you want to create something that speaks to you and says it that way, that's fine. Fez 2, though, it's like, well, you made it now. Now, don't get me wrong. He could come back with the same argument and say, you know, well, it's still my game and my whatever. I don't have to do anything, but I just don't buy it as much the second time around.
No, totally. And I think that it speaks a lot to the stepping up. I sometimes think of you know, the indie art world as something that you... It's better if you go in, like, stages, right? So if you have a lot of success, like, straight out of the gate, I think that it can cause more problems than it solves, right? But if you kind of take the next step and, you know, like you said, being able to kind of project manage and work with people and get them to follow you, very much what the whole Iron Grimes thing is, right? Like with his programmers, where he's like, oh, it's like I think it and you make it possible and stuff. I mean, to me, that's unfortunately a case of maybe he just wasn't ready for the next step, you know?
It's tough. It really is. And it's like, and you do lose, like, everything is always going to lose its shine once you hit the peak. That's the first thing. Like, I sat Ed down on this because I, you know, as a lawyer, 10 years, like, people don't always understand that was my dream, guys. Like, you know, I did have a dream to become a lawyer. I actually failed out of law school the first time and then came back to England to do it the second time. And man, when I got that job, like, that was a long time of culmination for me. And the fact that I've been doing it for 10 years now, like, don't get me wrong, now I want to move into film because that's like my next goal. But that's just the type of person I am. Like, you have to celebrate the wins, because as soon as you get them, it all starts to fade a little bit. You know what I mean? Yeah, so totally. The shine comes off everything. And film will be like that for you or like everybody else. Yeah. Like, you know, you're only as good as your last film. So that's, I just think, what they suffered from on that one. I you know, the story to watch, I think, that made the film was not so much Phil's story, even though I think that adds a lot to the drama of the documentary. Yes. The story, obviously, to me, was Edmund and Tommy. And just, like, how that just changed everything for them. You know what I mean? It made their lives different. And Edmund continues to be... I love his... Like, he used to have, a Twitter account and a blog. And, like, every time I remember seeing this guy, he was always, like, in a dinosaur onesie. And I just... effing love the guy. I was like, I know you don't like people, Edmund. That's cool. Part of the reason I like you, and I would give you the biggest, most uncomfortable hug, because I'm sure you're not a hugger. And I'd be like, I love you so much, man. You're so brilliant. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because he just encompasses the artist. Like, that is what every artist is like us inside. It's this scared little, like, not kid, just this guy who just wants people to understand where you are, like, what you're doing, and that you're not crazy, that you're just an artist, and that you just have the need to express yourself to people in that way. And he's just so good at it. As I said, Binding of Isaac never got the fanfare that Super Meat Boy did, but an equally good game, you know what I mean? And one that's been around. And I don't actually know what any of these guys are up to these days. I did not have a chance to Google, so it'd be interesting if people want to put in the comments what everyone's up to now. But
I was particularly enamored with Edmund. Just his whole relationship with his wife, and just how supportive she is, and how she gets it. But then it's also hard because, you know, there's that moment where he says, yeah, she said, we're in the same room, but I only ever see your back.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many aspects of that that are like, again, this is why indie filmmakers that are watching our show, that listen to our show and love this stuff. Of course, it hit home for me, but it's something everybody needs to understand.
Yeah, like you are exactly. It hit home for me as well, and I don't have a partner.
Exactly, but if you did, like when you get into this game, the indie game, like, you know, not the indie video game industry, the indie film is the same way. Like, it's a family effort, guys. Like, there is no way that you're ever going to do all this work without your family knowing, because you're not going to be rich. Indie filming, Lloyd Kaufman is the only guy I know, you know what I mean, who has an independent studio that has made consistent money since the 80s. And that's because Lloyd is a workaholic, man. He works hard for Troma and all of that. You know, the rest of us, like, that's the joke. Everyone says, oh, your studio's got to fail because it's indie. And it's like, I don't believe that. But I also believe that if you're going to continue being indie, you have to do it on a shoestring budget, because it's just one of those things. You don't have access to the gluttony that I think, you know, exists in more, you know, when you have shareholders, as it would be. You know, that's just one of the facts of it. But what I loved is the balanced approach they had, because a lot of times when you see spouses in these things, and I get really pissed at this, and Ed would too, because Ed knows about my relationship with my wife. Now, my wife and I get along just fine, and we love each other, but trust me, we've been married for 10 years and together for 15. Like, it's not all roses all the time. You know what I mean? And so I liked that they showed that with Edmund too, that, like, she wanted the cat and she wasn't happy that they've been poor for so long, because that weighs on you as the other person in the relationship. You're like, I'm sorry.
No matter how much you love them, you know, like, and you, they always do, right?
You know what I mean? Like,
when they showed the footage of him proposing to her.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
you know me, man. Romantic that I am. I was just like, that was so amazing. That was very cute. So amazing.
Very, very cute.
Good for you, Ed.
And he has like serious beard game. I was genuinely jealous when he popped up with his beard, and I was like, that beard looks amazing. And then later he like calls it out. He's like, I'm the lonely cowboy.
Yeah, man. Yeah, but that was his way of dealing with 6 months of like, or 6 years of like, you know, programming in a dark corner and creating in a dark corner.
And the whole crunch thing. I mean, I think that's perhaps...
That's what they're trying. You know, so going back to what you said about the opening scene, that is trying to explain to you the like why programmers get pissed about crunch, because crunch only happens. It's, you know, I imagine film works the same way when you've got VFX. I've heard about this happening. So The Hobbit talks about this when we talked about big budget stuff. But you're literally working on things up to the release date, because the release date isn't set by you. It's set by the company, who says you're coming out on this day. And as much as you love to plan,
better be ready.
Exactly. As much as you want to try to plan and get it done, it never seems to be ready on time. So you've got to kind of
never.
And so with video game studios, like, crunch is a real thing. You can read about it everywhere, because they bastardize these guys for the last 6 weeks with no sleep and nothing. These guys in indie studios are probably doing even longer, but it's on their own back. Yeah. So that was part of the thing I thought was cool, because if you're crunching for Activision Blizzard at that time, you're probably giving them the finger and being like, I'm just going to move to another studio once I get done with these guys. And that's usually what happens. If I'm honest with you, they burn out at one place and then they just move on to another that burns them out and move on to the other. This, they were like, well, at least it's ours, you know what I mean, we'll do it, and I haven't slept in 5 days, but I don't care, because it's mine and you know, it's out there.
That's the difference, isn't it? That's the difference. You know, the idea of making it, the idea of getting to work on these big budget films and stuff like that, that's great, and we would love to do that. But it's more about doing our own thing. It's more about expressing ourselves.
You know, it's the kind of thing, there's always so much, because the success rate is low, like, there's always so much depression and negativity around film, and around indie film especially, being like, you know, trust me, we all sit around with other filmmakers. This is why you have to avoid other filmmakers sometimes, because you will all just start shitting on each other and being like, we're never going to make it. We're all going to die. This is all horrible. We're going to be poor the rest of our lives.
It's easy. It is easy. And again, like, I really identify with Tommy, where he's like sitting with his family. And he's obviously still being interviewed and stuff. And he's like, I don't know. I don't know if I'll do this again. Like, I don't know if I want to work in games again. And I was like, yeah, a lot of people, man, that's just how I feel. Especially when you're in the thick of it, right?
That's right. That's right. And like, so the positive spin I would try to put on it is this. Like, listen, indie film is your ticket to, at least that's how we see it, as our ticket to getting into filmmaking fully. You know, I don't have a degree, neither does Ed, from filmmaking. We never intend to go to film school because it would cost too much money and take up too much of our time. But we want to be in the industry. The benefit we have is the first, second, and third things we can put on the table, that at least that's how I see it in my plan, you know, are going to be ours. And so because the first thing we make is going to be very low budget, you know, like we have so much control over what we can do. And listen, this thing we just got greenlit, like that was the whole point. The guy who greenlit it made it to us. And he said, listen, in this manner, you will have complete control over this story. I'm going to give you X and you can come over to do Y. And then all of a sudden you're in the driver's seat for this. And we appreciated that because it is so rare. The minute we start taking money for our films and things like that is the minute we hand over control. Why? Because someone else is paying for it. And that's how it works. So when you work
that's the reality of it, right?
Exactly. When you work your way up to, like we went to, that MCU level or that Star Wars level, like, trust me, you'll have enough of creative direction, I think, to do the job, but I don't. It's going to be the job. You're going to be told, here's, you know, I guess I'll just use, I was going to use Ant-Man, and I felt bad that it was like, that's not shitting on Edgar Wright, you know, but that's the job. It's like, you have to make Ant-Man. You have to do it this way. You can write
it. And if you're not prepared to do that, then you step away, you know, and I think everyone kind of finds their, you know, their not, I don't want to say level, but kind of what they're comfortable with.
That's right. You know, especially in the horror community, you will meet guys that just independent films. I said Lloyd Kaufman's one, but there are others that that's what they want to do. They're like, I don't care if my films make money. I don't care if they're big. I just want them to be what I make. You know what I mean?
Out there, and my vision. And,
yeah, exactly. And in that context, all you have to really make sure you're doing then is make sure that you've got enough that you can survive. And I think that's the big reason that I look at myself as stepping up, because I don't know if I could survive that way for, you know, any period of time, because I have a wife and a daughter. And, you know, it's just wanting to leave a legacy for them and leave something for them to have to move on with and all those things. I just don't. You know, a starving artist is not something that I've ever kind of set them up for. So that's the way it is for me. But that may not be your path. You might be, you know, the thing I liked about Phil is he reminded me of, in all the good ways, he reminded me of Anna Billier, you know, who still won't be my friend on Facebook. Anna, accept the friend request. I'm a good guy, I promise. But you know what I mean? Like, when I read how long it took you to make The Love Witch, I was like, oh my God, like, no, I can't do that. Like, no, I'll be dead by the time that movie's made. You know what I mean? But for her, that's what she wanted to do, and she stuck by it. And it's like, I have nothing but respect for that. You know what I mean? Like, absolute respect. And I mean that in a really genuine way, not just saying like, oh, I respect him, but I don't like
on the back.
No, it's not a pat on the back. It's like, that is, to me, like, that's the people I read about when I was reading about, like, you know, Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, you know, the people that really live it. I'm just saying, for me, in my life, that's never how it's really going to work. So I've never looked at it that way.
I mean, I'm semi doing the starving artist thing, but I know what you mean. There's, again, it's just the comfort levels, finding your comfort levels and again, expressing yourself. And I think it's one of the things that really impressed me about this film. You know, obviously you always educate me on like video games, and you tell me about this and that, and I get to try things and stuff. But I know very little about the really kind of creative side of it. I know basically the tentpole, you know, big budget stuff, right? And to get this glimpse into that world, which I identify with so much.
Yeah, I wanted you to see. Brilliant. I mean, you know, who knows? Like, Ed always jokes about this. The old company was called Shadow Construct Games. Like, don't ask. It was a cool name. But Ed is always on my butt about, like, so when's LVP Games going to come about? Like, I'm not kidding. Like, if we did good, you know, we do good with you know, the next couple things on the plate, and they get out there. And I mean, that's a 2-3 year development cycle for me. So 2-3 years from now, if I'm sitting on top of a decent film and people are saying we did it, you know, we did well, then I would totally consider it. You know, I would totally consider getting some programmers sitting down and creating a game, because I think we'd be good at it, because the process is very similar to making a film. It's just, obviously, you have to make a game, so you have to think of the things we think about with the D&D stuff we do, game theory and things like that.
And then I could be Backstory.
We love that guy. We love that guy. Because that's us. We're D&D nerds, right? Like, D&D nerds are all about the backstory, baby.
Yeah. And yeah, I think you're 100% right, though. That, like, Edmund's story and Tommy's story. And I did read something interesting. I think it was on the Wikipedia page where the idea, the reason why they chose these three... Because I think they maybe followed other indie developers and stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah. I think they said that they wanted to showcase, like, the past with, like, Braid, the present with Fez, maybe, and the future with Super Meat Boy.
Very much so. I mean, this is a subculture film, right? And I'm telling you, if it was your jam, if you watched it and were like, that was pretty cool... You need to, like, catch the other interviews. Like, you need to talk to the guy who made Spelunky, which was another game that blew expectations away. Like, he's so humble, but such an indie programming nerd. Like, just awesome. Yeah. Just awesome. Yeah. These guys have creativity coming out of their ears, and that's what I love about it. And I guess my point is, one of the reasons I try to keep people going in the film industry, and I think, I'd like to think, Ed could probably give some basis to this, but we'd really need a third party. I think I get some traction is, like, we need to be more jazzed about the creativity that is right in front of us. You know what I mean? There is so much talent. All it means is you have to take that talent and you have to keep it going in a direction for a certain amount of time and something will get made. You know what I mean? And I see it all the time. I saw it first when I started hanging out with people at Fright Fest, but man, we've been all over now and I see it everywhere. And it's just, what really saddens me is that it doesn't happen, that we don't have... ten independent studios that can come out with stuff and churn out films for people, you know, because they're built to do that. It's the kind of thing that I'm desperately talking to as many people will listen to say, let's do this. Let's get some money together and put this together because this is what could happen. You could have this renaissance of, it was so beautiful, guys, when it first came out. Like, I'm not kidding it, because it wasn't just, Ed, it wasn't just the games. I mean, ask Becky about this. It was the music. They had these awesome independently made soundtracks to all of this stuff, right? Then it was the artwork. Everything was pixelated and everything was like going back to what you remembered in the 80s. It was like this it's
a little bit of nostalgia.
It's what they talked about, right? In the beginning when they're saying like games were our thing, right? I grew up with them and I totally identified with that, and it was like it just was a place to be. And that's what I'm talking about. That's my, you know, listeners abound here, like, that is what you need to create, the buzz, the place. Like, you need to make it feel hot. And man, indie game just made the whole scene feel hot for that amount of time. So if you're interested, dive into more than just the documentary. Find out, at the end, they list all these games out, right? Those are all games you can research, every single one of those, and they have a really cool story. My favorite is the one with the bunnies that kill each other.
Yes! Oh my god, I was like, I need to play that, like, now.
I have it. I'll have to, when you come over, remind me, and I'll put it up on
Steam.
Oh,
yes, we'll play it.
Because it's awesome. So, like, it's cool. So awesome. I have all of these games, because, like I said, they used to package them in huge bundles. They weren't expensive, and that's the thing, like, that's, I mean, it's part of the model I've been telling you about with indie film. Like, that's how they got them moved and shifted. People bought them in droves because you could buy it. If you saw it, was 800 credits, which would have been like $8, you know, on Xbox Live. As opposed to, it's sad because now it doesn't happen as much like that. Because, like, if you went and saw some of the bigger indie titles, they're like $30-$40 now. You know what I mean? So that's different. But if you're paying $8 for something, it's like, yeah, I'll play that.
Yeah. It makes a huge difference. Do you think then, because you mentioned earlier that, it's not the same nowadays, right? In 2021, the indie kind of game scene has been flooded. That's kind of what you said, right?
I would say that. So the last time I saw, and this is just my opinion, guys, so please, this is the kind of stuff that, like, if you want to comment in SoundCloud,
please,
you want to comment on my Facebook.
Yeah.
No, not even correct, just add to this, because I don't know. You know, I tend to play big budget video games now, not indies. And so for me, like, yeah, the last time I saw a real renaissance again was when VR first came out. So I bought an HTC Vive. Like, that's right. I got a bonus for my job that year, and that's what I wanted. Like, I just, because I
dropped it.
I've dropped it. I've been all about VR. It sits in a box in the corner of my house most of the time. Yeah. It's so sad because
I still haven't tried it.
Yeah, you need a big chunk of space to set it up. And it's
the space, isn't it?
I had it in my old house, but the house that I bought, the one I live in, like, I just don't really have anywhere I can put it with my computer. So, but when that came out, all of a sudden there was another semi-renaissance because people were, like, delving into things.
Right,
people were
trying
new things, much to, you know, very little success. I still don't think VR took off the way it was supposed to.
I know.
You know, when it came out. It may someday, but it still did not, you know, reach the heights that I thought it would when things were going. But no, like, you can go on Steam and they'll have a list of, like, what's hot indie-wise, but it doesn't feel the same way to me yet. Like, it doesn't feel hot like it used to. It doesn't feel like, oh, man, that's the new one coming out from these two guys. And, oh, this one, like, I remember, like, there were RPGs that were just so cool. It was, like, Sometimes Always Monsters, okay? It was an RPG, pixelated, looked like an old Final Fantasy game, except it took place in, like, a modern city and had nothing to do with swords and sorcery. It was all about, like, a relationship and a romance and things like that. Okay. Like, you know, there was a horror game called...
You can just, like, find interesting stuff.
Yeah,
like
it was people
stuff.
Just breaking out of that mold and saying, no, I'm going to make this. I don't see it as much now. I don't see... And maybe it's just because people aren't putting my attention to it, but I do not see the list of, like, 20 games where it's like, I've never heard of any of this, but I'll play it all. Mm. You know what I mean?
Right.
And the other thing they weren't obsessed with back then was, like, time. Like, it was, like, some games you could play in 20 minutes. You know what I mean? Like...
Yeah.
It wasn't all about... There was this one game that I absolutely love the music for. I still listen to the soundtrack all the time called Go Scurry. And all it is this dude, like, literally running from aliens on this tightrope that twists. And I'm not kidding. I used to stay up very late trying to win this game. Like, because it was, like, an old-school, like, Centipede-style game. And my wife used to laugh because I'd have, like, a black-lit room sitting there on my computer. Like, it was PC Bong style. You know, I was like, I'm going to win this fucker. You know, I'm going to get this guy. Mm-hmm. But that's what I mean. Someone had sat and taken something so simple. Like, it was basically Snake on a moving platform. And you just had to make sure you do it. But, man, the music going hard. Oh, man, it was awesome.
That's cool.
So last thing I want to talk about is just kind of hand over to you again on this, is talking a little bit about, again, because this is for indie filmmakers. And so this is a documentary. Why is this such a pretty documentary, Ed? I want you to go into a little bit of detail. You know, you've got probably about 5-10 minutes here to tell me why it's so pretty.
Okay. Well, clearly the filmmakers are they know their stuff. What I mean is, setting up a frame, the mise-en-scène, which is a very cinematic and booky kind of expression, but it means what you see in the frame. And, you know, documentaries can sometimes, not always, but can sometimes be very run and gun, like you're shooting just wherever you can, whenever you can. So you don't really have time to, you know, set up a nice frame when you're doing an interview, right? And in this case, I think they worked so well with the environment they had. There was one particular shot that I was watching where it was a talking head with Phil. So it's literally, they're asking him questions and he's just talking. But the angle that they'd chosen, so they'd gone off a little bit to the side and they had changed so that he wasn't like parallel. It's not like the camera was pointing right at him. It was pointing at him from an angle, right?
Mm.
And it was obviously a wide angle lens and the depth of field was really shallow. So a couple of times he kind of moved a little bit and he went out of focus, which I think for a lot of people would be like, oh, that's a sin. Like, if you were on a big budget thing, like, you would get, like, hammered if you're an AC and you go out of focus, right? Mm. But here, what they're doing is they're using that very shallow depth of field to create that blur, the bokeh, right, around him. And because they've got that interesting angle, you've turned what is, on paper, a very boring shot, right, of a guy answering some questions. And you've turned it into something visually interesting. Your eyes are looking around and seeing the blur and looking at his eyes. He was also very big in the frame.
Well,
this is
what I love what you taught me. Because, you know, in all the kind of the cinematic books that I'm reading through, because that's kind of the stage I'm at as a film director, like, you know, you're telling a story bigger than that, though, Ed, because, again, Phil is a person who is very much in his head. So if you eliminate all the other things around him while he's talking and blur them, it is really giving you a glimpse of probably, I mean, at least to our standpoint as the viewer, of how he sees things. because he does not, this is what I was telling you about the comment, like, he doesn't see the Japanese person he made the awful comment to. He's in his own head. And that's maybe where I can relate, because it's like, I know what that's like. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes the only person who understands you is you. You know what I mean? And that's the way it goes. So, but a camera effect to that angle, you know, with the blurry background, like you said, ultimately creates that effect as well, that he's isolated.
It tells the story, like, visually as well as just, like, what you're hearing and stuff like that. And so, and they're just very, very good at it. Like, clearly, I can't even remember who directed it. I don't think they directed anything else.
Even getting those, that, you know, the opening shot will get you alone, because that is not necessarily an easy shot to pull off. Like, I love how they're showing sprinkles of rain in a puddle, and I was like, do you know how hard it is to get rain to show up on a camera? And to get to show up that puddle so clearly, like, again, it's that kind of passion. It's that kind of, like, we want to make this work. And it's a mirrored shot. It's a shot that repeats later on. And another thing to bring you back into focus as to what, because you're going to go from bad times. It's a typical movie format. Another thing they did really well. So, again, I guess I usually chime in with story. There is story in documentary. You still have to create some sort of narrative. The narrative goes the traditional kind of, you know, Clapboard Jungle Fall is a similar one where it starts up very negative. You know, you're like, wow, this is all not happening very quickly. You know, they spend a brief time introducing you to the world, and then it's like, and these are the indie filmmakers, our indie game makers, and they're all in the shit right now because they're up against deadlines and they can't meet it. And then, of course, gradually as the film goes on, things start easing up and you have the let's play happy music because things are getting better. You know, and we go on. A little bit of drama with Phil Fish again, as we were talking about before.
Like, great, great drama, though. Like, seriously, that was the one thing that you definitely undersold to me, was how, like, intense this
film. Well, I mean, to be fair, from a story perspective, it's almost like they drop you into Act 2 and they drop you into Act 3 with the drama. The Phil drama drops you into Act 3, really. You know, the initial drama with Edmund and Tommy is what drops you into Act 1, Act 2. And you're like, here's the guys, here's what they're up against. You know what I mean? So, you know,
And just to shout out the directors, it was James Swirsky and Lizanne Pajot. And I think they're French-Canadian. They kickstarted it, apparently. But, these people know what they're doing, man. Holy crap. I would have given them another documentary.
Well, it's the interesting thing, because this is word of warning, guys. You know what I mean? Because this was back when you could kickstart a full film. And it's not like it's not done. You know, Laurie Brewster is kickstarting post-production for Dragon Knight, and he's raising his money that way. And I think he's almost there. Good luck to you, Laurie. I think you're going to make it there. But generally these days, guys, because I have been asked about this a million times, like, no, you're not going to crowdfund your film. Like, not the full film. You know what I mean? You're going to crowdfund maybe $5,000 to $6,000 of it, but generally you're not going to have enough money to make a full film off of
a Kickstarter. The days of kickstarting a full feature film, I mean, like you say, it's not like it's impossible, but...
No, I mean, stranger things have happened, but you know what I mean? Like, that 2010, that was very possible. Nowadays, not really, because people have gotten wise to the fact that they don't really get anything out of kickstarting your films. So trying to do it that way. So, but this, you know, created enough buzz on Kickstarter that got it done. And again, it's an amazing film. You know, it came through on every single level.
It's a criminally underspoken about film is what I would say. I mean, I would. And you know what? Even Icarus, which I kind of stumbled upon, which is the documentary about doping and stuff like that, is fascinating. But it got the buzz, right? It got the Oscar I think it even won the Oscar, or at least got a nomination and stuff. This documentary should have got a nomination.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I like about this, more than I like about Icarus and all this, like, listen, Netflix documentaries, guys, like, let's just get more depressed about how shit the world is. Like, you know, but it's completely fish in a barrel, because of course you're going to feel worse about the world after you watch a documentary that points you out. You know, this is why people always ask why I'm so cynical. I am a cynical person, even though I'm an optimist. But if that makes any sense to you whatsoever, I'm not even sure it makes sense to me. But it's because I'm a lawyer. It's because I have to see the insides of everybody's business. And you know, once you do that, you can't really walk back. You can't really say, "Oh, the world's a great place." Like, no, the world is a weird place, is what I would say. And it has lots of different people that do lots of different things. And most of what goes on in this world, we don't see. You know what I mean? It happens behind closed doors. what I liked about Indie Game, and again, I'll put Clapboard Jungle up there too, is it gives you a breath of fresh air to say, it's not all doom and gloom, guys. Like,
yeah.
if you try hard yeah. and you work hard, people do achieve things in this world. And so I wish more documentaries like this were made. You know, you yeah, could make one about definitely. Indie filmmaking. That would be just as cool.
That's a really good point, actually, because it is very uplifting. By the end of it, you're like, you know, it's not all that well that ends well, but, you know, there's positivity, and even, like, you know, for some of them that just saw utter doom and gloom, like, they, you know, there was light at the end of the tunnel kind of thing. You know?
That's right. And I just would say, like, maybe I'm crazy, maybe it's just faith, but that is how it works, guys. The difference between making it and not making it is the giving up part. That's it. That's right. it.
It's a marathon, I'm sorry, not a sprint.
I heard my That's whole life about say. This talent bullshit, and it doesn't exist. Mm. If you want to have talent in something, just do it. You want to be a great writer, write all the freaking time. That's all you have to do. Mm. You know what I mean? And keep refining it, keep whatever. It's not brain surgery. You know what I mean? And if it were brain surgery, just practice brain surgery at a hospital.
Exactly. You know? You could learn that.
You could learn to be a brain surgeon. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't like, and maybe that's a sign of the generation we grew up in, Ed, but, you know, I don't like that kind of theory. It's why I love the second of the Skywalker trilogies, the one everyone hates, The Last Jedi, because it was the first one that says, you don't have to be, you know, a Skywalker.
You don't have to be someone special.
You can
special.
Just be Joe Blow. Totally. And I was like, that's the kind of message that I want everybody to hear, because I believe that. I Completely. Really do believe yeah. that. And so if you want to have that belief too, I would watch this film. It'll make you feel better about your own creativity and what you're capable of. And you can see that, yes, it is hard. Like, it's never easy. It never feels great. And people shit, man. Trust me. I am a person with one job working on another right now. And I can tell you the look, stares, and comments that I get about, you know, my lifestyle choices at the moment. You have to just kind of push them away and say, you know what, guys? Like, you're entitled to believe what you want, but this is me and this is what I do. So,
you do you. Let me do me.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's hard. I, that's probably, at least for me, and that's maybe why I like this film so much. For me, that's the hardest part. I'm very lucky that I have a very supportive wife who, you know, as much as we don't see eye to eye on everything, we see eye to eye on this. And she knows, like, kind of who I am inside and why this is so important. You know, you will struggle with those other things, but like I said, don't give up. That's my final message. Don't give up, guys. Watch Amen. This movie and remember, if you have a dream, a sueñito, you got to do it too. You got to go for it. And you got to yeah. believe like this.
Hell yeah. Absolutely. That is the best message to end on, I think.
Excellent. Well, very good, everyone. Thank you for joining us. We are at 1 hour and 6 minutes, so I'm going to cut us off now. Next week, I don't know. I've been thinking we might do Black Widow because I'm going to go see it tomorrow. And I am Mr. MCU, so I would like to give kind of my indie filmmaker vibe thoughts on Black Widow. It's partly because you all loved what we talked about with Loki, too. So, yeah, fine. We'll do Black Widow as well. So, until then, please stay safe, everyone out there. Don't forget, please, to share, subscribe, get this out here. I want more listeners, please. Not because I'm vain and crazy, but because I think it's a good message to put out to people that you need to try, you know, on the things you care about. And I think we talk about cool stuff. So, if you do too, please share this with your friends. Tell them that you like the show and get the word out about what are you guys talking about. But that's it for me. So, thank you all and bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. Bye.